We're very fortunate to be able to spend some time now with Daniel Pipes. I read his columns on a regular basis in the Jerusalem Post. He is a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution and director of the Middle East Forum, which is a public policy institute that seeks to define and promote American interests in the Middle East and around the globe. And let me tell you, a lot of people will read anything that Daniel writes because it's always so insightful. And Daniel, when we asked you to join us, I didn't know that things would be a-poppin' in Israel, looking at what's happening from Gaza, Syria, and from Lebanon. And, of course, this whole idea of Nakba and Hamas saying, I give you four letters or four numbers, 1967. If you want to talk to us about the world before 1967, 1967, obviously a reference to the Six-Day War, we'd be happy to engage. But Hamas, again, declaring over the weekend, illegitimate. And that's what Israel will always remain to them. So what's happening? You wrote an interesting piece on this. Are we seeing a shift, a change, a different dynamic now?
Well, thank you, Janet, for the kind words. Yeah, I think Hamas says 1948. It doesn't accept the existence of Israel. And so-called Nakba Day, N-A-K-B-A, is about mourning. Nakba in Arabic means catastrophe. And that's a reference to the coming to existence of Israel, and it's rejecting Israel's very existence. Now, this has been around for some time, and indeed, the Arab states, the Palestinians, have been, for the entire existence of Israel, been trying to eliminate it. But I think something has changed. I have a sense that between the futility of the use of armed force, on the one hand, and the example of Arabs in the streets of Tunisia, Egypt, and other countries, shaking, if not overturning, their governments. Between these two things, the futility and of the Palestinians and the success of the Tunisians and Egyptians, the Palestinians are beginning to rethink things and beginning to look at a more nonviolent approach, a more political approach and less military approach. And I think this would serve them very well and will be difficult for the Israelis to handle. And I think that Sunday, the so-called Nakba Day, was perhaps the turning point in this shift.
Well, it's interesting because as you and I meet earlier today, King Abdullah of Jordan was meeting with President Obama, and the president in his few remarks to the press after their meeting said that the king and I, he said, I'm paraphrasing, talked again about the mandate for this so-called two-state solution. Daniel, that conversation has been around for a long, long time. Are we any closer, do you think, to the establishment? And maybe I should presuppose that question with, is that a good idea in general?
In theory, two states is a reasonable idea. The problem has been that the Palestinians have not, and overwhelmingly, I'd say 80% of the Palestinians have rejected the existence of Israel. So there is no operational two-state prospect. It's really just one state, the Palestinians replacing Israel. It's symbolized by the fact that in Arabic, you will not find maps that show Israel. You'll have maps that say Palestine. So two-state is reasonable in theory, but dysfunctional in fact. And because it's in fact dysfunctional, I came to the conclusion a few years ago that this is not a sensible policy for our government to follow, that instead we should try something that works. And there are no real great prospects, but I've come to the conclusion that what I call the Back to the Future scenario is the best, namely the Egyptians go back to Gaza and the Jordanians go back to Jordan. No one particularly is enthusiastic about this, but it has the prospect of a more reasonable kind of governance in Gaza and West Bank than what Hamas or the Palestinian Authority can offer.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. So let me ask you, as we look about the security of Israel going forward, the unrest in Cairo, the Tahrir Square uprisings, the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood is seeing more and more ascendancy, claiming more and more seats in the government to be established, the fact that one of the key spokespersons said that basically they want a referendum on the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. Let me just focus there before I move up to Syria and Lebanon. What do you think is going to happen in the days ahead? I'll ask you to practice prophecy here a little bit, Daniel. What do you think will happen in the relationship between Egypt and Israel, given the fact that things are in play now in Egypt?
Well, a little bit of background. I don't see the military having come to power in February with the demise of the Mubarak government. I see it having come to power in 1952 when there was a revolution and the military overthrew the constitutional monarchy. And I see a fairly strong continuity between five military rulers Naguib, Nasser, Sadat, Mubarak, now Tantawi. I see Tantawi as not that different from Mubarak, having a similar outlook, which is on the one hand military, on the other hand Islamic, on the other hand nationalist, not much different. And so I'm prepared to predict that the elected president, if there is one, if they don't call some emergency situation before that, that the elected president will not have that much power, that he'll be more of a semi-powerful figure, and that the real ultimate power will lay in the hands of the generals, and that we will see much more continuity than change, and whether it be a peace treaty with Israel or harassment of the cops or whatever other question it might be. I see fundamental continuity. I see a coup d'etat having taken place in February, stimulated by Tahrir Square, but executed by the military leadership.
So will there be much change when the dust finally settles?
I don't think so, no. I think, I note that there are some real negative developments since February. For example, vis-a-vis the cops. But I think also something positive has emerged, namely the spirit of Tahrir Square, that we hadn't seen anything like that before. Until now, any major demonstration of tens or hundreds of thousands of people has been invariably outward-looking, blaming the United States, Britain, Israel, extremist, conspiratorial, and so forth. And in Tahrir Square, we found something that was inward-looking and self-critical and talking about responsibility and democracy and accountability, and this was remarkable. Just haven't seen that before.
Yeah, I so appreciate your optimism. So you touched on it quickly. Let me go back and ask you to dig a bit deeper, if you would, please. The aggression we're seeing against the Coptic Christians, it's never been good for the Copts there, but now it's gone from bad to worse. What do we subscribe that to?
I'm not exactly sure, but I'm inclined to think that the military has given free rein to the most aggressive Islamists, the so-called Salafis, to harass and kill and burn cops in their churches, perhaps as a mechanism by which to declare martial law and end the election process, the democratic process. I don't know who Tantawi is. And I don't think many people do. But I have dark premonitions here of something going awry.
And on that note, let me flip and go up now to Syria. Daniel, you know that area. So do I. I've been in the kibbutz up there. It's a beautiful vista. It's important militarily. It's important domestically to Israel. You write with accuracy that in a totalitarian state, citizens from Syria couldn't have walked across into the Israeli border without permission from the government. So who's pulling the strings here?
Well, it appears that the government exploited two things. One, the fact that there is this move to start having people march. It's not just in Syria. This move towards nonviolence. And two, the fact that the government there is under great stress, and this is a way of changing the subject, as the Obama administration properly noted, surprisingly noted. I see the situation as one where we will do very well if Assad is gone. Although I think the major danger in the Middle East, or in most places around the world, is radical Islam, Islamism. And although Bashar al-Assad is talking about Islamists being the threat, I'm not so worried. In part, I don't know that the Islamists will take over in Syria, but more importantly, I know that whoever takes over, Islamist or not, will no longer be allied with Iran. And I see Iran as the great threat of the region. And therefore, the Iranians will lose their key ally in the western, to the west, in Syria, and I think that's of great importance to us. So I'm hoping that the regime falls, and I'm hoping that our government and other governments will start pushing in that direction, at least to say that they want the regime to fall. Something, for example, they did with Gaddafi and with Ben Ali in Tunisia and Mubarak. They can do it with Ben Ali and Mubarak, who are rulers that we got along with. Why can't they do it with Assad, who is aligned with our enemy? wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think, and I'm going to bring in Lebanon at this point, do you think that somehow the action in Syria and the action in Lebanon are indicative of the fact that behind the curtain there's some proxy movement from Iran?
I read that there are, in fact, Iranian operatives and their arms operating in Syria. I find it surprising. You would think that Syrians mm-hmm. would know how to handle their own population. It's a totalitarian state. But the problem in Syria is that when push comes to shove, the majority population of Syria, the Sunni population of Syria, has little loyalty to the Alawite rulers. And so that may be the reason why the Alawite rulers felt the need to call on Iranian forces. I don't see anything like that happening in Lebanon, but that certainly is the case in Syria.
Oh.
I think it's the case in Syria, I should say.
Okay, sure. All right. Question. Is it just the fact that Israel just celebrated her 63rd birthday that created this sort of coincidental action out of Gaza, the West Bank, Jerusalem, Nablus, all at the same time? Or do you think that there was someone or some group in particular orchestrating these demonstrations at the same time? Coincidence or orchestration?
Oh, clearly it was orchestration in that the... for example, there was a Facebook page that had 300,000 members on it until it was disbanded, calling for this kind of action. So it was organized.
It was organized.
Yeah.
Now, we learned today, Daniel, and I find this interesting but not surprising, that Benjamin Netanyahu has winged his way to the States and he's going to come here. I don't know what his itinerary is. I'm not sure what his agenda is, but... What kind of a position is he left in, turning to the United States when the president has already stated again what many think is the right way to go, which is this two-state solution? What are we going to do? What can we do to help the nation of Israel at this point?
Well, not only has Obama endorsed the two-state solution, but reluctantly so has Netanyahu. The question is, under what terms do these negotiations take place? And I think the Israeli position has been ironically... made easier by the fact that the Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, has recently formed an alliance with Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
And our official governmental position is to draw a major distinction between these two, to see Hamas as a terrorist organization, but to fund the Palestinian Authority. I don't see them as very different. Or to put it more humorously, I see them as good terrorists and bad terrorists. And, that the good terrorists, the Palestinian Authority, have been shown up by their alliance with the bad terrorists and have condemned themselves in this way is, I think, useful. It kind of clarifies things. The Palestinian Authority is really no different from Hamas. Just uses different tactics.
Absolutely.
I think there'll be less pressure on Netanyahu than would have been the case otherwise.
Wow, amazing. You know, it's interesting because I read that just yesterday, Mahmoud Abbas apparently had a series of local meetings because he wanted to discuss the possibility of launching a large-scale uprising targeting Israel. So I'm with you. Hamas, Fatah, it's two halves of a whole. Do you think Israel, and again, I'm asking you to be prophetic here, Daniel, but do you think Israel is on the cusp of a third intifada?
I think it's going to be more... nonviolent than that was. That it'll be large numbers of people marching on checkpoints, on the security fence, on Jewish towns in the West Bank, and the like. Now, on Sunday it was pretty violent, but I think the trend is towards nonviolence. There's a recognition that nonviolence will go places that violence won't take you. So mm-hmm. I think the Israelis are just beginning to realize what a challenge they face in this regard.
Exactly. One last question. Every time I go to Israel, I am seeing more and more blue berets, more and more vans emboldened with the type UN. Are we going to see, do you think, in the not-too-distant future, some superimposition from the United Nations to kind of set up a de facto government in Israel?
There's certainly... an increasingly assertive intellectual movement in that direction. In fact, our own representative of the United Nations, Samantha Powers, Susan Rice, mm-hmm. is someone who has shown sympathy to that viewpoint, as well as Samantha Powers, who's in the White House. But I think we're a long way from it.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. And I'll tell you what, Dan, you've just given us more reasons to be praying for the peace of Jerusalem. Thank you so much for being with us. Daniel Pipes, very, very well-respected authority on the Middle East. He is a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution and director of the Middle East Forum. If you'll visit in the market with janetparshall.org, you can click on and visit Daniel's website as well as the website for the Hoover Institution.